Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's March 20th, 2010. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. Just a little over 2 weeks ago in the Texas Democratic Party primary, there was a shock delivered by the voters of the 22nd Congressional District to the political establishment throughout the world. A candidate, Keisha Rogers, running as a LaRouche Democrat, campaigning for the impeachment of our narcissistic president, Barack Obama, was elected by Democratic Party voters in the party's primary to be their candidate for the November 2010 elections. This shock was followed on March 13th by another historic webcast by Lyndon LaRouche, in which he clarified how the dynamic process which led to the Keisha Rogers victory represents a now unstoppable dynamic, which will lead to not only the end of the Obama presidency in the near term, but the coming defeat of the Anglo-Dutch Venetian Empire as well. And this has led to some interesting commentary, which just appeared in the last couple of days. According to a Harvard professor and an imperial spokesman, Niall Ferguson, the impending demise of this empire and its puppet Obama could lead to a new dark age of several generations or even centuries. This was presented in a piece he wrote called Complexity and Collapse, Empires on the Edge of Chaos, for the upcoming issue of the Banker's Foreign Affairs magazine. Or it could be, as LaRouche Youth Movement member Sky Shields wrote in a memo immediately after Keisha Rogers' victory, it could be the rebirth of a Mars colonization project based on the reassertion of a Riemannian approach to physical science and a rejection of the radical positivist outlook enforced by the empire and expressed in the Ferguson article, which is committed to a reduction of human population on our planet from close to 7 billion people to less than 2 billion. So joining me on the LaRouche Show today to discuss this extraordinary opportunity will be Sky Shields, who wrote the memo, and Alicia Serratani from LPAC TV, who was a coordinator on the ground with Keisha, organizing the incredible breakthrough which has reverberated far beyond the physical boundaries of the 22nd Congressional District of Texas. So Sky and Alicia, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
All right, glad to be here. Thanks, Harley.
Sky, let me begin. Hello, how are you both doing? Let me begin, Sky, with you, because you opened your report by saying that Keisha's victory represents a turning point in world history. What is it for you that defines this potential turning point?
I mean, it's interesting because this gets to the principle that we're investigating in the so-called physical sciences with our Cosmic Ray Project, which we'll get to discuss later, but which is perhaps a little more clear in social and political processes, that there's a point, people typically have a misconception where they expect history to be made, large changes to be made by the people who possess the most clout in terms of money, in terms of weaponry, or in terms of whatever else, that whatever forms of power people are inclined to worship at any given moment. But what you saw with Keisha's victory is that what is inevitable about the development of human society is that ultimately you reach points of inflection, of crisis, where it's purely principle that matters. And in the case where principle is brought to bear, it gives the impression of a much weaker political force, right, as we are in all the typical terms. We don't have a lot of money. We're certainly not well-armed. We're not very powerful in the typical senses what people typically mean by powerful when they discuss politics. But we do have principle on our side, scientific principle on our side, and that's clear. What the decision to elect Keisha in the 22nd Congressional District in Texas by the population there was their responding to the tide of history. They're responding to the necessity of the human species to turn from the direction it's been headed and then to move in a direction that's more sane, even if the people, the voters themselves, couldn't articulate it in those words. And that's exciting.
Well, I think Keisha articulated that in the connection of the impeachment of Obama to saving NASA. And clearly you picked up on that in your memo on Mars colonization. To what extent, and I should ask Alicia this question as well because she was there on the ground, but to what extent, Sky, from your view, does this become a conscious process, or how does it become conscious, this connection between the failure and the incompetence and the disastrous nature of the Obama administration, and on the other hand, the potential embodied in NASA?
At this point, right now, the majority of the population, I think, understands instinctively, because they're human, that, yeah, what this administration represents, what Obama represents, is something predatory. It's something that's dangerous. It's in opposition to their physical survival. They see this in what was done with the, instinctively they recognize this by what he's doing on health care. They recognize it in a more explicit form by his demonstrating his allegiance to the banks with the bailouts. They can see in policy, they recognize that his attacking the manned space program, the U.S. manned space program, is an attack on their future. Again, they may not understand these in an explicit sense, but instinctively, anybody who's human recognizes that what this administration represents is something that's anti-human. And so they've been able to respond to that. My view right now is our job in aiding, working with Keisha's campaign and the task that Keisha has before her now is making that understanding explicit to the population. We've got a major educational project here.
Well, Alicia, you were very struck in the organizing by the way in which what Lyndon LaRouche talks about as the Percy Shelley principle or the mass strike process becomes manifested when there's an organizing principle, a higher organizing principle in a sense, reaching down and connecting them to these universal principles. Why don't you just describe a little bit what you saw, the way this was working in the campaign in the 22nd District?
Well, I think that it worked. Our organizing worked, and the victory happened because, Like Sky had said, it was instinctual to the people there that what was going on was, in a sense, canceling their future, writing off the future. Even if some of these people working in NASA are looking at retirement soon, but they knew still that this policy was, instinctively, they knew what the implications were. It wasn't just losing a job. For a lot of these people, it was dead greater implications. But what we did, what we were able to do with the direction of LaRouche is bring them an idea that was outside of the process that they found themselves in. Because as it stands right now, the rate of the economic collapse has most people in a big panic, whether it's their mortgage, their job, their children's future. And so, being human, they react in saying, look, I don't like this. I'm going to fight against these cuts in whatever capacity people have been able to do it. But what needs to happen and what we are able to do as a start, as a foot in the door in the 22nd District, is to give them a positive conception, to clarify why they have this instinct that shutting down human spaceflight is it's a little bit different than shutting down the local supermarket. And it's developing that positive conception and getting people to begin to defend what is human about themselves and their children and mankind generally, and have them fight at that level. And we were able to bring that into this campaign. And then saying, so we didn't, working with LaRouche, we have a unique perspective because of the discoveries he's made and what he represents just as a cultural tradition. We have a unique opportunity to see really what mankind represents, because in today's culture it's largely lost or it's hidden. Our job now is to get people to fight on that level, defend what mankind is. Not just putting out certain fires that are happening more and more, putting them out, you know, as they spring up, as the economic collapse, you know, worsens.
Well, I liked what you both said about making something that may be instinctual, connecting them to a universal principle behind it. And I think I'd like to ask you also, Alicia, on this question of the mass strike process, to what extent, you were there, the district includes the Johnson Space Center, NASA, to what extent are people able to get over their immediate problems, and how did Keisha bring them to confront this idea that they have to think 25, 50, even 100 years into the future?
Well, I think the one thing that we were able to do that a lot of other, that, you know, neither some of the scientists could do nor the political parties could do is we brought the two together. We brought a scientific mission, which is colonizing the moon and Mars as a programmatic approach of Keisha's campaign, and the political fight, the best option, what to do politically immediately, together in one campaign. And because that's the only way they make sense. You can't have science without politics, you can't have politics without science. The two are ultimately part of the same, you know, the same whole. And that clarified for people what their mission has to be, what they have to do. Because in a certain sense, the population today is really rendered impotent because all of these things are dichotomized. That, you know, this follows this and that follows that, or, you know, you're a scientist, so therefore you can't be a politician. You're a politician, therefore you can't be a scientist, whatever. Everything's fractionalized. So by clarifying those things, we were able to literally act on the universe and get something to happen, get an advancement in the process by, you know, putting the question of impeachment on the table as a reality nationally and internationally, and putting this question of human spaceflight, which is something that's going to have to happen if we're serious about having any kind of future for modern civilization. So we put those two together, and it makes sense. If you think about it, it makes sense that they have to be put together, put on the table together.
Sure. Well, that just leads into the next question. Before I get to it, though, I want to give our listeners a chance to participate if they'd like. You can send a question via email to Sky and Alicia at radio@laruchepub.com. That's radio@LARUCHEPUB.com. And let me also say you can go on laruchepack.com website, where there's an interview with Sky Shields from, I believe, last Tuesday on this question. It was on the Off the Cuff. And there's also Sky's memo available there, Keisha Rogers' Victory Launches the Rebirth of a Mars Colonization Policy. Now, Sky, what Alicia was just talking about really brings up this probably most controversial aspect of your memo, the interrelationship between the investigation of cosmic rays and social processes, or you might rephrase it as, how does progress in civilization occur? Now, in investigating this, if you look at it from Lyndon LaRouche's standpoint, this is not a paradox or controversial at all. But from the standpoint of modern science, and as Alicia was just saying, from politics, it is a paradox. How do you resolve that paradox?
The main thing is, I mean, this is something, again, this is something that on one level is going to be instinctive to the people we're talking to. But they've been trained, most of the population, especially the majority, if not all, of the scientific establishment in the U.S. and abroad has been trained not to recognize certain things, almost aversion training, where you're not supposed to this is the effect of certain trends of positivist philosophical trends in the U.S., in U.S. culture and U.S. science, and the world culture, world science, I should say. Where certain principles that are obvious under other circumstances. For instance, under any other circumstances, it's clear that there's nothing in the universe that is not affecting anything else in the universe. You've got one universe. It should not, from an intuitive level, a real human being should recognize that it's not possible to study the universe as though it were an agglomeration of objects, or just a collection of facts and little bits of material that are acting on other material, but that instead you'd want to take a real systems approach, an approach to sort of treating the universe as one, and to view the subsumed processes in it as processes that are necessary for the development of that universe as one. You know, intuitively that should be clear, but people have been drilled with over the last several decades this idea that that approach is not scientific, that real science is this radical reductionist approach where you're taking elements down smaller and smaller and smaller and then trying to find a theory of everything where you build the universe up in the large from these tiniest pieces. And that's led to nothing but paradox and dead end. Things that are insoluble, not because they're fundamental paradoxes. There's nothing natural about the paradox up in quantum theory and in other places, but only because there's paradoxes in the way the problem is being approached. It's just telling you more about your the errors of methodology than it is about the science itself.
Well, Sky, let me ask you, because you said that this is from the last decades, and of course there you're talking about quantum theory, but this approach has actually been at the center of the battle for several millennia, going back to Aristotle, and then Lyndon LaRouche has recently emphasized the important shift that occurred with Paolo Sarpi. So
yes,
we're actually dealing with what is literally an imperial policy to treat science in such a way as to dumb a population down, aren't we?
Exactly, yeah. This is imperial policy, but earlier this last century, we had the ability to break from this. If you look at what was represented in the period leading up into the British operations of World War I and World War II, if you look at what you had there in Germany and then in the United States, if you look at what you had around the work of Einstein, the work of Planck, both of them playing off of Riemann's conceptual approach, Riemann's philosophical approach to the physical sciences. If you look at what you had there, there was the potential at that moment to free ourselves completely from this, from these reductionist approaches to the physical sciences and to philosophy generally. But then an operation was run, a very serious operation was run against Planck in the form of the introduction of positivism, but then all of its sort of sister diseases, positivism, behaviorism, reductionism more generally. All of these were launched in order to destroy this trend and then to force us in the direction that we went after the Copenhagen crew took over the Solvay conferences, which is towards...
And it shouldn't be surprising then, the way you just developed that the same reductionist approach that destroyed advances in science was then applied to human social dynamics.
Oh, immediately. Yeah, exactly, immediately. And if you look at the people who are promoting it in the sciences, in most cases you'll find that their ulterior motive was to be able to promote these as methods of social organization. I mean, it's significant. Take a von Neumann. Take any of these guys, compare their scientific philosophy with their political and social philosophy, and you find these things go hand in hand. And on the better side, you'll see that the people who oppose this kind of fascist approach, like Einstein, who opposed the fascist policy as political policy, also opposed it as scientific methodology. In their minds, it was very clear that you were fighting, that there was there was a unified philosophical approach they were fighting for, and there was a unified philosophical disease that they were fighting against. No, yes, certainly.
Yeah.
And it makes it clear to people that to break themselves right now from the fallacy of free trade, from the disease of monetarism that's controlling society now, it's necessary to have these radical changes in philosophical and science, in our conceptions of the physical sciences.
Well, I was just, you just anticipated where I was going next, and I'd like to throw this out to Alicia. The relationship of these kinds of conceptual methodological approaches to economics. And you know, we see in the district the irony that you now have Democrats lining up to try and remove Keisha or to diminish Keisha and not have her, you know, to have the Democratic Party express on record that she is not a Democrat. And yet these are the same, they're appealing to Democrats or voters who are losing everything because of the policies of a so-called Democratic president. So how do we make this connection between the social processes, universal principles, to economic policy? Alicia, how do we do that in our campaigning?
Well, one thing, and this is what LaRouche brought up today in discussion with his associates earlier this morning, is that the American people have to become conscious. They have to become aware of how their nation has been subverted. And there's this interesting case of this Niles Ferguson, who he's basically an imperial spokesman, as you said, Harley. And he wrote a piece basically mapping out this eminent dark age, which is something LaRouche has been saying all along. And this is what the American people are beginning to live through, is the beginning of a dark age.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're human, because it's instinctual, you're having this mass strike effect. But what our mission is, what needs to happen immediately, is for these same American people who are having all, their whole lives come down around them right now, recognize that you're really seeing two systems confronting each other. You're seeing the American system, the American legacy of Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, Lincoln, the Founding Fathers. You're seeing that, which is represented through LaRouche and the campaigns that we're running, and the things that Sky in the Basement are pushing in terms of the scientific frontiers. That whole legacy expressed as a policy through statecraft is confronting right now a British imperial system, a system of empire. And that confrontation has really defined world history of modern civilization as we know it. And the way that LaRouche communicated today that this is often done, that nations adopt policies of austerity that cut services to their people, like what's happening today through the Obama administration, is through an ideological slavery. It's through, it doesn't just happen in science. This is like we're discussing the whole theme of this show, and what you find in organizing is that, a philosophy and ideology about the nature of the universe goes hand in hand with economics and statecraft.
This is real politics, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. And the point that this is the point that LaRouche made is that the British, if you can call them, the British intellectuals who are running the empire, who have deployed people like Niall Ferguson or Barack Obama, Tony Blair, George Bush, Dick Cheney, the British intellectuals know and have known throughout history that all of the crap, the positivism, the empiricism, the free trade, they've known. They don't believe a word that they're saying. They put that out there to enslave populations ideologically to make the wrong decisions such that this empire can have control over them. And that's what the American people, and I think the American people are ready and are smart enough to figure that out. Because another thing that came up in the discussion is that's the real issue of morality, and that you're gonna need a strong moral commitment to progress to get through the political period that we're in right now, because it's getting very nasty.
Well, and this comes back. I want to come back to the Ferguson article, because Sky, I think there's something in it which gives away the anti-scientific and in fact points to the truly satanic nature of this kind of argumentation, that he looks at human progress as something cyclical, that the empires rise, they fall, that almost as though this is a law of nature. In other words, that the universe, including human social dynamics, are not really dynamic, but they're characterized by entropy. Do you want to comment on that, Sky?
Yeah, I mean everything. To the extent that the entire introductory portion of his article was not completely just bullshit and smokescreen. Except there was any content, it was in reinforcing the view of the universe that empire always wants the population to have. I mean, the most crucial philosophical conception to impart to a population if you're running an empire is the futility of an attempt to change the universe that you live in. And so you look, there's certain philosophies that are always favored by empire, which have nothing to do with their scientific validity. It has to do with their political effectiveness. And these are his whole section on so-called complexity, which has nothing to do with complexity. It's a hand-waving trick to try to ignore the fact that real systems, that real phenomena in the universe have a gestalt character where they can only be treated as wholes, where the whole is not equal to the sum of the parts. The whole is more than the sum of the parts. To try and avoid this, you get all these different types of chaos theory, fractal sciences, the so-called complexity. None of these are science. They're all ways to try and convince people that something like free trade works, that somehow you can run an economy by not paying attention to running the economy, that somehow the sum total of all of our animal desires will add up to produce something in the large. Because if people believe that, if you can really get people to believe that this is what economics is, then when you come in and control the process, when you as a banker, when you as a financial power come in and steer that thing, the population honestly believes that there's nothing they can do to stop you, which is what you have right now. Why don't you have any sort of response from Congress or anywhere? The substantial one you should have to the bailouts, to the idiocy of free trade and deregulation.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second, since we are talking about the spawns of Satan here.
Okay.
Isn't it the case that they can argue that in fact human civilization has gone through what appear to be cycles of ups and downs, that human progress has not occurred as a continuous process? And so the flip side of that is to ask the question from the standpoint that you presented in your paper, how does progress in civilization actually occur?
Mm-hmm. I mean, any one of these things, this is true. I mean, this is the same game they play with the economics or with history. If you present the thing statistically as a chart, you know, it's going to go up and down. There's only two directions really your chart can go, is up or down. Up and down, left and right. So you're going to see these little, you'll see humps. The question is, what is actually happening physically at the moment you see the progress or you see the decline? Those are actual decisions made by individual human beings which cause those changes. The overall direction is upward. It's progress because this is human nature. But none of it, the progress nor the decline, happens automatically. This is because you have individuals who decide to drive human progress. All human progress is defended upon the actions of a handful of people at any given moment spread throughout history.
Go ahead.
So the collapse, the periods of collapse that you see are because of bad decisions that are made. Right now, we're at a point where we have the option. We've got the choice. We have the ability to exercise human free will now to decide which direction are we going to go in. Are we going to collapse the way Ferguson and his British controllers are calling for? Are we going to collapse with Obama? Or are we going to dump Obama and then move in the direction humanity should have been moving in, you know, really some time ago? Get back on the track towards the economic development of the solar system and the universe and beyond.
Well, you're listening to The LaRouche Show. We're talking with Sky Shields and Alicia Serratani, taking up the question of the interrelationship of the creative physical universe and creativity in human beings, in individual human beings. And again, if you, I know you're probably thinking about some questions and having a hard time formulating them. If you do have questions, you can email them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. If you don't have questions that you're ready to write down, pay close attention, because you're going to have some by the end of this program, because you can tell the direction we're going is really part of an organizing process. So let's move into this next part of the discussion of cosmic radiation. Sky, on the question that following up just what you said, in a sense, there's a paradox here of what Lyndon LaRouche has been talking about as weak forces, identifying human life as a very weak force in the grand scale of things in the universe, and yet he makes the point that these weak forces represent the most powerful potential. How does that work?
It's one example that's clear. I mean, you can do it in two stages. If you compare first living processes to the non-living, and then after that, do a comparison of cognitive processes to the living but non-cognitive processes, and then to the non-living ones that are below that. You're comparing between the three phase spaces of the Russian scientist Vladimir Vernadsky. Now you compare the first two. You compare the abiotic to the biotic. And in terms of sheer, on an individual level, again, the example I like to use is sort of, just because it's sort of vivid, dropping a rock on some small animal. The majority of animals would be killed by the equivalent size rock, whereas dropping that animal on the rock would not do any damage to the rock at all. It would also damage the animal in both cases. Just the example is to illustrate that sort of physically, from the standpoint of physical forces, I mean, comparing most of the activity of any animal to something like an earthquake, life seems like a much weaker, it seems like a weaker phenomenon than the abiotic, than the non-living. Some of this leads to, but then viewed in the large, you take a look now over a much longer time span. Take a look at the over the course of geological time, and you realize that life as a whole, as a one, is the major driving force in shaping all the non-living. In the uplift of mountains, in the formation of oceans, in the shaping of the restructuring of the Earth's crust, life, this seemingly weak when viewed as a snapshot, is the most powerful geological force. Between the two, between things that you might call native geological forces and then the biotic ones. Likewise, if you take, so again, you have a comparatively weaker force that, because it is qualitatively more effective, is dominant in comparison to the quantitatively more powerful force. So the weak forces are what are driving the thing. If you now compare, you introduce human beings into it, we might be one of the weakest things in the biosphere. I mean, short of given in terms of just mass to effectiveness ratio here. People like to point out that the most animals in the biosphere, sort of when left to hand-to-hand combat against a human being, would do considerable damage. I mean, even things that seem rather...
Well, maybe not rabbits.
Yeah, maybe not rabbits, but then perhaps. It depends on the rabbit, honestly, and the circumstance, I think. But you get...
Well,
like,
rabbit once attacked Jimmy Carter, supposedly.
Oh, really? Okay, we'll see. I'm sure he used some clothing or some technology to defend against it. But you take a look at that, and you realize... But then you take a look at the effect of human beings, human society, and again, you see that this, we've reshaped the entire biosphere using what? Human thought, human ideas, human cognition, which is the thing that's typically, it's the first thing written off by the reductionist, because it's absolutely unquantifiable. It's almost equal to zero as a force. If you were to say, what is the mass of a thought, or what is the temperature of a thought, or what's the energy throughput of a thought, of an idea, you would register zero. And from a quantitative standpoint, you register this thing has zero effects. It would have zero effect, but then you take a look at it qualitatively and look at the effect on the Earth's surface and beyond as a whole, and you realize that this thing, this thought, human creative thought, is the most powerful force, not just on the planet, but in the universe. And it gets you this, it's in that is this principle of weaker forces being the thing that dominates, being the most significant factor. Simply because they're weak, no, but because the way they operate is qualitatively as opposed to quantitatively.
Well, and then Sky, and also Alicia, I'd like you to comment on this next point, because then what you're talking about actually is how does that activity of in one human mind, perhaps, the discovery of a universal principle made by one human being, become part of a more powerful social process. So we're back in the social dynamics. How does that get organized, including in physical terms, in terms of energy potential, energy flux density, as well as just in social terms of creating a renaissance? I mean, that's really what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. And yeah, and Alicia, I'll let say some on this also. But I mean, in short, that recognizing that, starting to be able to realize it now, that this, that it is this social process, that this the invisible effectiveness of thoughts of the individual creative human being mediated through a social process, which is then mediated physically through the universe in the form of human economy. But that process, if you can start to get a sense of that, you can start to get a sense of what we're talking about when we're talking about solar system development. We're not talking about, you know, sort of optionally sending out this probe or that probe or sending this person or that person. We're talking about looking at the solar system and the universe as a system, as a single system, and then acting on it economically, developing it in that way. We're acting on the dynamic in the exact same way as a society. So this idea, if you can get a concept of what human society is as a dynamic, as a harmonic, as the driving principle, although it can't be quantified in any simple sense, but as the driving principle for human economy and through human economy for the organization of the universe, then you can start to get an idea of economics. Mm-hmm. But then working backwards, you can start to get an idea of what the significance of this cosmic ray project is that we're working on.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to say now, in what way is the universe already organized on the basis of the abiotic, but then also on the basis of the biotic? Because you're asking yourself, in what way is the harmonic set of interactions throughout the universe, which you see their discrete expression in the form of the different field structures, different types of radiation that you get spread through interplanetary, interstellar, and intergalactic space. But if you can start to recognize that these are one continuous system, which are playing a role in the development of the biosphere on Earth, and you begin to have to ask yourself, well, exactly what are the physical limits of that biosphere, if that's the case? You know, it extends much further than the surface of the Earth. At that point, you can start to get an idea of, well, what is this system in the universe that we're acting on to develop? What is this pre-existing harmonic system that we're going to tap into and change ourselves as this weak force in the universe of humanity?
But Alicia, you've been doing some work on this question of where we have to go with energy development. I assume you see the same thing Sky is just talking about in terms of the problems of dealing with an irrational population that's terrified of nuclear energy, but nevertheless has no other alternative.
Right. Well, this is where it gets fun, because at the end of the day, when the cows come home, there is an accountability to the way you think. Your culture and what you choose to do is not just your decision. As a human being on planet Earth, what we're finding, because of the nature of the universe that we are living in, is that we, as mankind, have a certain responsibility to continue to create and develop, taking a cue from what the abiotic and the biotic have created. I mean, just thinking about the intricacies of just the human body, or any biosphere, or a desert or a rainforest. There's a interaction. It's not arbitrary. It serves a purpose, and it's got a directionality to it. And so the question of culture, to say that the culture and economic policy is somehow arbitrary, is crazy. Anyone can think about it for just a couple of minutes and say, okay, well, maybe I do have a purpose here. Maybe there is something I'm supposed to be doing with my life. And then, so when this freak out around, consuming and creating more energy, lots more energy. I mean, we're talking about not just electrifying the planet, but we're talking about building industrial bases on the moon and on Mars and other, and terraform, you know, bringing life to other planets. So we're going to need to create, you know, if the environmentalists are pissed off about the kind of energy production we're using now, they're going to have a heart attack when they find out what we're planning to do and what we're going to make happen in the coming century. Because what you realize is that our job is to create. Mankind's job is to create. And the discoveries that led up to Einstein and William Draper Harkins, is that his name? I think so. They made their way through a whole arc of discoveries, Mendeleev, the Curies, Becquerel, down into the subatomic. And in making these discoveries about what matter is, they made, you know, they sort of overthrew all these other assumptions and hypotheses about how the universe worked. Now, they weren't just discovering how matter works, you know, how energy works. What was happening in this arc of discovery is how the human mind works and can discover how the physical universe works. So there's a relationship there that is undeniable. And the fact that we were able to discover and are currently sort of working on, today is mankind is working on how to master a fusion reaction, that it's not just an energy policy. It's not just a, you know, it's not just a different power source. It's, in a certain sense, you have to look at it and the ability for us to be able to discover things like that, really, as LaRouche had said recently in a paper, puts us in a position as assistant to the creator. We have the power to create.
Well, and this brings me to, you know, it's very interesting how this discussion is going. And Sky, remind me, I have a question for you on Einstein from one of our regular listeners. But Alicia, just to follow this up, this is where Lynn starts raising what he recently started calling a question of theological strategy about the nature of man. Because what you were just talking about is that obviously part of the fragility of human life is that it's not everlasting, that we humans are fragile. We should have a longer life expectancy than we have, but nevertheless, we're going to die. And this question of immortality, of getting people to think of themselves as part of this historic development of civilization into the, you know, outside of the Earth's atmosphere and into the astronomical phase, that this is really where you see the problem, why people allow themselves to be dumbed down and stupid, because they get trapped in their fear of this question of immortality.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why there has to be a culture. You're not going to have, I mean, there has to be, the culture has to support individuals to be bold, especially coming out of this culture. There has to be there has to be cultural support to be bold and to break with popular opinion and to really change your identity, or what most people's identity obviously is at this point, to a creative assistant to the creator. That is an incredibly profound idea, and that's a lot of the reason why what LaRouche is doing with his youth movement is not just, you know, to do the political legwork. It's to force a change, force an upshift, act as a catalyst in the culture today to bring out the best in people, bring out in what human, you know, in the people that you talk to every day, that's already there. You just, it has to be catalyzed.
And that's really the organizing process, not getting someone to agree on a set of recipes for an economic policy, but to get people to recognize that higher potential that resides in them. And in fact, to act in such a way as you demonstrate your love of humanity and your love of that person's potential, as opposed to what a practical, stupid jerk they're acting like in their day-to-day activity.
Right.
Well, Sky, let me ask you this question, because Adam Rodriguez is a regular listener, and I'll read what he said, and you can take it up however you wish. I said, could you please explain in more detail how this moron Niels Bohr and the Copenhagen School twisted Einstein's theory that light travels in wave light quantized packets of light into a mathematical equation? So there's a lot of interesting thoughts in that one sentence, but what does it bring to your mind?
I mean, this is the what was there. There was Einstein began, you know, launched and then began a real revolution. Not just with his work on relativity, but with his and Max Planck's pioneering work on quantum phenomena. And what he said, he made the point himself that they were. He expressed his opinions in written form and elsewhere, that we were on the verge of a new type of causality. And he says, Einstein says, that it's the type of causality that the causality we're moving towards is as different as the kind of, that you could compare the causality of physics prior to a beginning piano student at the piano plunking out a number of notes but not understanding their connection. Is understanding their sequence one after another, to the kind of causality that's involved in a Bach fugue, is his exact comparison, where the causal interrelations between the portions there aren't governed from one part to another. But there's a type of unfolding of the whole that is what governs the relationship among the parts. And Einstein was clear on that, and he said, well, this is a different type of causality than typical physics, which requires point-to-point, object-to-object, and he was tackling that from the highest philosophical standpoint. Now, Bohr and the crowd, the Copenhagen crew, their approach to this thing was largely incompetent and then corrupt. The idea was to try and to say, well, yes, there's problems with causality, we'll throw it out the window, and we're going to impose this completely unknowable statistical model that can only be described mathematically, but there's no knowable reality connected to it. And so they push this imperial program again. The universe is not knowable. The universe is describable, perhaps. There's statistical relations that you have to subject yourself to, but fundamentally, it is not knowable. It's of a character that's completely different from the character of the human mind. Now, this is the, as you described earlier, Harley, this is what Bohr and the Copenhagen crew were promoting, is an ideology that goes all the way back to the oldest known forms of empire. That this is an ideology that's completely antithetical to human creativity, and it's meant to crush any expressions of it.
Well, and so if this ideology prevails, then Ferguson will be right, and we'll be in another cycle of destruction of civilization.
Precisely, where you get where the British or some other imperial entity is expected to crawl out on top like roaches or something. But the real direction, if you take a look at the direction now instead, that what was the real revolution that should have happened at that point? What was the revolution that Einstein and others were on the verge of pushing, of promoting, and what is the one that we're in a position now to carry through as part of our political activity? It's to a view of the organization of the universe and a view of causality that is premised upon the exact same principles that govern human creativity, human creative thought. It's an image of the universe as a creative one. And this is what Einstein was fighting for, in arguments that have been largely misunderstood up until this day.
And he never, Sky, as far as I know, he never capitulated in the face of the withering criticism directed at him for not developing a mathematical model.
Oh, never once. On this, I mean, he worked on organizing, well, he was working seriously on what a functional model was. You know, there's a possibility, the development of the correct physical model will allow you to create you'll have mathematics produced as a shadow of the thing. And, you know, and there's a desire to have the shadow to be able to work with. But you never say that the real ontological, first, you never state that there is no ontological existence. There's no ontology to the theory you're creating, but then also you have to recognize that this human creativity is something that's fundamental to it. This is not something that human creativity is not a phenomenon that's added on top of the physical universe. Human creativity is the anti-entropic development of the universe is primary. The biological substrate to direct that, to manifest that, and then the physical substrate to manifest, to control the expression of that biological substrate, those are the secondary phenomena. The idea of the atom, the idea of abiotic physics, these are derived from a principle of human creativity. And Einstein understood that.
Well, we have a little less than 10 minutes, and I want to try and pull a couple of these threads together. But I want to encourage our listeners who are finding this to be quite a provocative and fascinating discussion. On the LaRouchePack.com website, you can find a whole series of videos, including the Moon-Mars colonization videos, discussions of physical economy, credit versus financial policy. Virtually everything that we're doing, that the LaRouche Youth Movement is putting out, the work that Sky and his colleagues are doing in the basement under the direct work with supervision of Mr. LaRouche, is aimed at making clear that this is the only pathway of survival for the human race. And I'd really encourage you to get to know the LaRouche Pack website as your actual living university, because there's no way you're going to be able to be fully effective in this fight just by mastering the points of the LaRouche plan. You really have to know where that's generated from. And Alicia, I'd like to come back to you on a question that you mentioned to me before the show, that one of the things that LaRouche brought up today was the relationship of this whole question of social processes, cosmic rays, to the question of morality. Because you have the phony morality of the Obama team saying that the moral imperative is this health bill, you know, a moral imperative that they're planning on killing off whole sections of the poor, sick, and elderly in the United States. So Lynn talked about where real morality comes from, and I wonder if you could present that to people.
Sure. This came up at the end of the discussion we were talking about earlier, that you have a whole movement through academia, through different, you know, social, ideological outlets to skew population's idea of how the universe works and their role in the population. And Lynn said this, he said that if you take people's identity of their role in the universe away, you're taking away their morality. Because if you skew what their role is, what their responsibility is, then you're taking away any checks on their behavior, and that what people do or think is okay to do in a limited time of their life becomes habit, or, you know, they do what's popular. So what LaRouche's point was is that morality, the meaning of morality, is the defense of this exact role of mankind. That we play an incredibly profound role in the development of the universe, and that role needs, obviously, as you can see with what's going on today, culturally, politically, economically, that role needs to be defended. And it's the defense of that role, it's the securing of that role as man is a creative being. And that's expressed in many different ways, scientifically, musically, artistically, politically. But that role needs to be defended and secured and protected. And it's not, as you see, it's not, you know, morality is not, it's not arbitrary. It's the commitment to man's role, which really is a commitment to the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, I gave a presentation not too long ago, and a young man there said, well, I'm the practical sort, and I need direction on how to do things that are practical. And I said to him, well, I have a practical challenge for you. You have to become immortal. And he was somewhat blown away by that conception, but he took it thoughtfully. And essentially what you're saying, Alicia, from what you just said, is that the solution to the so-called practical person is that they have to be impractical in the same way Keisha's campaign was impractical. That is, you take up what's necessary and operate from the higher standpoint. So I presume that you're looking forward to the next months on this campaign, where not just with Keisha, but also Rachel Brown in Boston and Summer Shields in San Francisco, that we're going to demonstrate that the only thing that's practical is for people to become moral and immortal on this higher level.
Exactly. And the fun is going to be getting people to reflect on why they think something is practical. What is it? Who made that decision for them? And that's the best. That's the best organizing anybody who considers themselves to be political can do for somebody else.
Well, our colleague Cody Jones once described it as a good organizing session is one that leaves a bunch of mangled, bloody axioms scattered around the room. So, Skye, speaking of mangled, bloody axioms, where are you guys going with the basement work now? I know that Lynn has been very definite on looking at this question of cosmic radiation and defining, taking as a starting point your memo on now Keisha's victory has opened up the universe to us. What kind of things should we expect to come out of the basement in the near future?
Well, we're going to be launching, in fact, a very harsh and a very detailed attack on this positivist approach in the physical sciences, but then also more broadly. And one of the central pieces right now is going to be revisiting that conception of this question of what is matter. So revisiting the debate that took place between Einstein and Bohr, and continuing the work that Einstein was doing, his understanding of causality, from the standpoint of this, you know, we say cosmic radiation, but as Lynn's been saying, LaRouche has been saying, what you mean is harmonics. Well, you're looking at what are the principles that exist not as discrete points throughout the universe, but exist as universal principles which act everywhere in the universe as though at once. And then to begin with that is your model for causality, because that is the way principles interact. And then to see their shadow as generated singularities that you call matter. The things you call particles, these are not things that have an actual discrete existence. They're singularities that are formed as the intersection of large-scale, harmonic, wave-like properties, wave-like phenomena. And if you can begin to reclaim that idea, suddenly you realize that if that's your view of the universe, if the universe functions in that way, which we're familiar with, by the way living creatures interact, by the way human society functions and human ideas work, these are the physics of human ideas. If you can reclaim that as being the actual way that the universe, the physical universe, functions, suddenly all of these paradoxes that arose in the debate around tackling the quantum are seen to be, as I said earlier, not objective paradoxes, but subjective ones. They're telling you that your understanding of causality was wrong in the first place, specifically the exclusion of human creativity and the exclusion of morality from physical law. The idea that morality, as Alicia described it, does not exist in the physical universe, that assumption leads you to a dead end. You've got to return to the idea that morality, creativity, these are efficient physical principles, and that's our direction.
Skye, I don't think Niall Ferguson is going to be too happy with that direction coming from the basement, but I think he and his friends should just ride the cycle down to the hell that they're trying to create and let the rest of the human race move ahead into this new era that you so boldly proclaimed was opened by Keisha's victory. So I would encourage our listeners, because we're just at about the end of the hour, go on the website, work through these ideas, make them your ideas, make them your discoveries, because as you can see, there's no way you can actually be a human being without challenging what you think and what you've been taught and learning to think for yourself. So Alicia and Sky, thank you very much for your participation today.
All right, thanks for having us, Harley.
This has been the LaRouche Show. We'll be back next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for another provocative hour, trying to get you to take up your responsibility as human beings to make this planet livable, and then also make Mars and beyond livable. So thanks for joining us, and we'll be back next week.